My name's Kevin. Are you ready to rock and roll? If you're here for the very first... That wasn't intentional, was it, Rich? We're ready to rock and roll. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to jump right in. I got a lot to share with you. So back in the 8th century BC, a gentleman by the name of Romulus, who is the mythical founder of Rome. A lot of people debate whether or not Romulus was an actual historical character because of his name, Romulus being etymologically connected to the name Rome. So a lot of people think that Romulus might just be a mythical character and the name just means Mr. Rome. Anyway, the story goes that Romulus decides to found this city. And the city that he wants to found is going to be an asylum city. Back in that particular day, throughout all of history, people were criminals and they participated in all sorts of crimes. People would put them in jail, but he wanted to reestablish a kind of a new way of being. So he created an asylum city, and at the asylum city, it started to be very successful. All these prisoners got to be set free and liberated. But there was a problem. How many of the, male sex are in jail versus the female sex that are in jail? You understand what I'm saying? So he begins this city with a very stark differential of genders and realizes that the city cannot sustain itself. So he calls together a festival called the Neptune Equestre. Fascinatingly enough, I found this image, which is obviously recent, not from the 8th century BC. This is a recent image of somebody actually participating in, a bunch of people participating in an actual ceremony of Neptune with a huge statue of Neptune in the middle of this. So I was absolutely thrilled to see this. So people are still participating in these festivals. He calls together this festival, the Equestre of Neptune, in order to call all the cities around to bring in all of their people. Now, at one particular point in the festival, he gives a signal to all of the men, and he says, "This is now the time." Those men, upon that signal, were to take all the virgin women, available women, and then steal them as their wives. Now, this is from a city called Sabine. And Sanina, who is the king, obviously did not appreciate this because it was very much a ruse, right? This is, I'm going to throw a party, but the reality is I'm going to steal a bunch of women. So the king of Sabine decides to go to war against Romulus. And that particular war begins this epic story of the founding of Rome. King Sanina, having military power and might, thinks that he's going to be able to take back his not only the women and, of course, his dignity, but he's going to be able to destroy Romulus. It's actually the other way around. Romulus actually destroys and beats and wins that war against Sanina. This is actually a story that is told in the modern musical, if you've ever seen Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It's based upon this particular story. So in the 8th century, around 752, 753, or 754, depending upon how you're counting, Romulus defeats Acron, king of Sinia, March 1st in 752. Now, several hundred years later, when Rome has now been established as a city, Caesar Augustus decides to tell an account of the city. And this is really important, for if you are hundreds of years after its founding, you need to know who are you, what is important, what kind of people are we, our identity. So he begins to document all of the major events that happened throughout Roman history, all the way back to its founding. And he marks March 1st, 752, as year one, AUC, I don't speak Latin, or AVC, which stands for Ab Urbe Condita, from the founding of the city, or Anno Urbis Conditae, in the year since the city's founding. This is wonderful archaeological evidence that would show that 752 BC, like what calendar system were they using? We use 752 because, you know, it's 2024, we're going to go to 2025. We have our system. They had a very different system, and during the reign of Caesar Augustus, this is right during Jesus' time, Caesar Augustus documents that actually that year, the year that Romulus beats Sanina in that war, is year one. And that year one is going to be the documentation, that's going to be the very, very beginning. If that year is year one and Romulus beats Sanina in March, then March is month one of the calendar. I have always wondered why our calendaring system didn't make any sense. Why is September, which means seven, the ninth month of the year. It never made sense to me. October, which means 8, is the 10th month. The reason? Right here. Because if you count from March 1 all the way through, you start to match up. Oh, we have actually inherited this very calendar from 752 all the way back. March 1 is the marking, is the beginning of that time. Year 1, month 1. Romulus beating Senina is the marker for who we are and how we understand ourselves. Now, we could spend a lot of time here. Rome goes on to, of course, conquer what is essentially the known world. That's not exactly true. That's a very Western-centric way of thinking about, let's just be clear. But in this kind of history telling, for all practical purposes of the Western world, they begin to conquer the entire world. As one historian puts it, like frogs surrounding a pond. Now, part of the reason why that story of year one is so important is because who Rome is, how they conducted themselves, the culture that they created, and the kind of people that they wanted to be in this world, and the kind of people that they wanted to bring into their empire, was based upon the story, the legendary story of Romulus, who was a sneaky king, well, wasn't a king at that time, asylum seekers, and decided to rape and pillage the women of the surrounding cities. Defeat those enemies in battle, and that becomes the established story for who Rome is. And throughout the rest of the Roman Empire, you see this over and over and over again. Year one established for them, who am I? What am I doing here? What are my ethics, my values, my culture? How do I see myself? Well, you can imagine that some of these people did not take very kindly to this. I mean, if a foreign enemy people group were to come in and take over your land, you wouldn't be very happy about this. Based upon our Christian and Jewish story, there are two specific people that come to mind. In 66 AD, Joseph ben Matthew, who later becomes Josephus, a historian that many of you may actually know, decides to rise up against Rome. And they have this epic battle, and you can read all about it. We've been to some of those places at Masada and Gamla where they have these epic battles and try to push back Rome. And Rome essentially has difficulty trying to get these people to submit. Eventually, Rome does fall in 70 AD. Jerusalem falls in 70 AD, and the Roman Empire continues. In 132, another gentleman by the name of Simon Bar Kokhba begins to rise and says, you know what? Joseph couldn't do it. I'm going to do it. He calls himself actually the Messiah. I'm going to be the new Messiah to liberate Israel out of this Roman oppression. So they rise up. They're going to fight their battle, and they're fighting against Rome, right? The empire. These are the people we need to kick out of our land. They begin to mint coins and to establish a whole new kind of government. Now, we've talked about this before. If you know anything about Hanukkah, if you've been around Spark, you know that the palm branches, in the Jesus story, right, the laying down of the palm branches, it's not a nice kind of, you know, Christian symbol that you sell at christianbook.com. Oh, no, it is a nice Christian symbol that you sell at Christian. But originally, it was a battle kind of banner, a flag, a very nationalistic kind of symbol. So they begin to mint these coins because why? They're going to overthrow Roman government. Now, I'm skipping over a whole bunch of things. There's a lot of history here. One of the things that's key to this particular message that I want to share with you is that when they decide to do this, they mint coins with the year, with the inscription, what? Year one. In 132 AD, our chronology, they mint coins that say year one of the freedom of Israel. I know I'm going to get a little spicy here. This is like a middle finger to Rome. You think you have the clear established idea of what it means to be a people group? You have no clue, and we're going to crush you. And just like you had your establishment of year one, we are now going to have our establishment of year one. That was the old time. That whole period, those hundreds of years that Rome had, those are not going to be the stories, the legends, the ethics, the ways in which we think about ourselves. This overthrowing oppression That's going to be the way that we see ourselves. Year one is one of these incredibly fascinating things that humans do. Marking time. Now, I don't imagine that many of you have spent a lot of time philosophizing about time. Does it even exist? Is it just an illusion? Maybe some of you have. I spend a little bit of time like part of the reason why I'm crazy and don't think very straight all the time. What is time? How is it passing? What's fascinating for me is that humans throughout time have had this penchant, this propensity, this need to mark time. And to say at this particular moment, this is something happened here. We're passing through time, and at this particular moment, something happened. And how we mark time, just like those months, those years, the calendar, how we mark it is profoundly influential for how we think about ourselves, who we are, how we live and work and breathe in this world. It is what year coming up? 2025, right. But we're in a synagogue. Jews don't count according to the Gregorian ancient Roman calendaring system of 2025. If you take a look at any Jewish calendar, you will always see two dates. One is the international date that we use, 2025, which marks, of course, Jesus' birth. But you'll also see another year, 5785. What does that year mark? In this year, it is not 2025, according to the Jewish calendar. According to the Jewish calendar, it's 5785, 5,785 years after the creation of the world. We mark the creation of the world for Jewish folks, for people who hold to this tradition and liturgy, from the creation of the world. And what that does for your sense of spirituality, your sense of identity, yes, creating, making, turning chaos into something beautiful and organized. That is who we are. So much so that if you spend any time in a Jewish community, you will hear frequently the phrase tikkun olam, repair the world. At the very base ethic of Jewish thought and practice is to repair a broken world. And it is greatly informed by how time is marked. 5,785 years after creation, because creation, Genesis 1 and 2, that's the good stuff. That's what informs who we are. Fascinatingly enough, nations today still do this practice. Does anybody know what year it is in North Korea, in the People's Democratic Republic? Now, notice these are the only two calendars that I saw. The international calendar that we use are in parentheses. The real year, Juche, is the year after Kim Il-sung's birth, the beginning of their particular country. So the calendars that they use mark the birth of their ruler. And then, of course, in the 6th century, Dionysius Exiguus decides all of these calendaring systems that we've had multiple of them, all of these, you know what's really most important? What is the thing that has transformed the world? What is the thing by which we should mark who we are, our identities, and how we think about ourselves? Of course, he was thinking about the time before Christ and the time after, Anno Domini. Now, I'm terribly sorry to let you down. He was off by a couple years. We know that Jesus was born somewhere between 4 and 6 BC. So it is 2025. So it's actually going to be 2029. Or 2031, depending upon how you want to count that. But nonetheless, that was his. And that is why we have established for us what is year one that has now dominated the entire world, the birth of Jesus. I've been incredibly fascinated, as I mentioned before, by this ticking of time. People frequently want to celebrate anniversaries. They want to, when we get to this particular time of the year, we go, oh, we're getting to a new year. People talked about the new millennium when the year 2000 rolled over. You know, all these heightened sense of awareness, this propensity of humanity to mark time as being profoundly meaningful, deeply informative, and kind of guiding of who we are has been around for ever since, you know, humanity's been here. And it's not just with calendars. It's also with ourselves and our lives. Many of you know people who have gone through struggles such as addiction, and when they tell you their story, it is not 2024, 2025, it is 12 years since. It's been 5 years since. It's been 16 years since. When there's a death in the family, this is year one of grandma, grandpa, uncle, brother, sister, who's not with us this holiday season. Of course, 9/11, October 7th for Israel, it's becoming one of those years. And of course, we have things like the third millennium. We are in the third millennium. Are we really in the third millennium? Like, who's by whose count? Who says? This idea is something that has been with us and will be with us forever and ever. And it informs who we are. Part of the wonderful practice of liturgy, community, and religious awareness is to stop for a moment and to truly consider when we say 2024, when we say those numbers, what are we actually saying? And what does it tell us about who we are and what kind of world that we're living in? This is something that I would encourage you to think and to consider. This is something we're going to do. But I would also like to propose to you the very thing that we use to order our world is also a very thing, the very same process can sabotage who we are and can make our way through this world very challenging. So what I'd like to do is propose to you, my friends, this paradox. All of what we've just done, we will still continue to do. There's nothing that will stop us. Let's celebrate an anniversary. January 1 is going to come around. We're going to roll over the clock to 2025. We're going to have to shift that clock again on daylight saving time, which hopefully we'll be able to kill next year. We're going to have to do this. But I also want to point out that the paradox is this. Our desire and penchant and need to understand who we are from both the past and where we are going into the future is also a double bind. It can challenge us, and it can hinder us. And I'd like to propose some thoughts and reflections for you for how we then move forward and why I've entitled this moment is actually the most important moment of your life. Part of what I wanted to do tonight is to read the entire book of Ecclesiastes. So here we go. We'll just read a portion. We'll just read a portion. This is just the introduction. If you are unfamiliar with the book of Ecclesiastes, it is a teacher, Kohelet in Hebrew. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. I consider myself a teacher. This is what I do. The teacher is supposed to provide information. The teacher is supposed to inspire their students. A teacher is supposed to help their pupils become better human beings. Not this guy. Listen very carefully, and I hope it inspires you to actually go read the whole thing, because it's profoundly disturbing, but very eye-opening. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes, and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full, to the place where the streams flow. There they continue to flow. Life just goes on. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. Profound, deep, isn't it? There is nothing, nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago, not remembered. True. Nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come, but by those who come after them. The entire book continues on with this kind of riff of how everything is meaningless and meaningless. The word hevel in Hebrew is this image right here, is the word vapor, mist, smoke. It's here. You can see it, and then it's gone. And the writer of Kohelet, the writer of Ecclesiastes, says, this is everything. Everything. It's here, and then it's gone. This is what we need to think about and consider when we think about what the teacher is trying to tell us. And this is also part of the reason why thinking about the past and thinking about the future and trying to find ourselves in this flow of time is so critically important, because everything comes and it goes and it's here, and this moment right here is here. But those Spark services 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, and the ones that are coming, I mean, where are they going? We don't know. Everything is this mist. So we're caught, my friends, I would suggest, between two kinds of things in this flow of time. The first is we look to history through a fun glass mirror. We distort it frequently. We tell stories about what has happened in the past, and I'm going to suggest to you that we are completely ignorant and blind to what is to come in the future. And so for no matter how many times we want to say, year one, this is it, this is what it is, we don't know actually what it is that is going to come. Rome had no clue about the uprisings. The Bar Kokhba revolt had no clue about what was to essentially happen in the future. We are stuck between these two things. The flow of time and the marking of time is, sorry to be a downer, vanity. It's all a vanity. And this is the great paradox. Let me give you some examples and I see this, once you start thinking about this, you kind of see this all over the place. Bessel van der Kolk, just this book made it to the top of the New York Times bestseller list multiple times. Recently, after the pandemic, it shot up again. Gabor Mate's book, When the Body Says No, these are books, as well as many, many others, that explore trauma. Now, the difference is, to understand trauma, you have to understand that trauma is not the event that happens to you. Trauma is the thing that happens in you. Trauma is the thing that happens in you that marks a moment in history, in time. And for those of us who have experienced any sort of trauma, we know that that year one continues to sit with us and goes with us constantly. Why? Because it wasn't about the event that happened. It's about what happened inside of us. This kind of history distorts the future. Whatever the traumatic event is, triggers, unfortunately, things that remind you of that event that could be innocuous and kind and lovely and wonderful and we're scared of. We can't move forward with. This is why the work of trauma and trauma-informed healing and care is just so critically important. Nadine Burke Harris, in her brilliant book, The Deepest Well, she was the Surgeon General of California for, I believe, 2002, 2006, was one of the first to advocate for the understanding of adverse childhood experiences, the number of adverse childhood experiences, the negative things that have happened and how they deeply inform and guide where it is that you go. This, my friends, is part of the history that we funhouse mirror view. Trying to mark essential time is difficult and complicated because of this. We think that what happened then is what is going to happen into the future. This is part of the challenge and part of the process of healing, part of the process of growth, part of the reason why you need to be a part of a community. Find a good therapist. Be in deep connection with others, because that's the process of healing. Another area where this is relevant, I've been a big fan of Ken Robinson for a long time. In his book, The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything, he kind of takes the educational system to task, and he says, we have established an educational system in this world, and especially in America, that is stuck in a particular period of time, in a year one of what we think education is supposed to be. And he writes extensively about how creativity and the arts and the humanities are so critical to our human flourishing and to our being. He writes, there is a basic flaw in the way some policymakers have interpreted the idea of going back to basics to upgrade educational standards. They look at getting back to basics as a way of reinforcing the old Industrial Revolution era of hierarchy of subjects. We're trying to churn out workers. That's what our educational system is designed to do. Not designed to figure out, where does humanity flourish? Where do you live? What gives you life and what gives others life? So we create systems and standards, etc. There's another way in which this happens. A lot of us think that we live in a particular kind of America, and then all of a sudden something else happens. Some of us think that we are living a particular kind of church, and then something else happens. We have unconsciously, subconsciously, unknowingly marked a year one. This is what I thought our country was. This is what I thought my church is. This is what I thought. And then, of course, we come to find out maybe it isn't. And we get caught off guard, and we try to figure out, wait a second, what is this thing? The entire agenda, the entire experience of deconstruction is often deeply related to this idea that we had a year one. We thought this is what it is. This is how we shaped our identity. This is what we shaped our understanding of faith and even our country. And the reality is that's not year one. Things are changing. Things are moving. Things are evolving. And that year one is no longer year one. So the past is very difficult to think about critically. What about the future? Well, the future's we're completely blind and ignorant to the future. We have no idea what's going to happen in the future. I'll give you the most palpable one, perhaps. Does anybody know the name of Alan Lichtman? He's a political prognosticator. He has these 13 keys. The 13 keys are ironclad predictors of who's going to be the next president. Listen to him.
It's going to be a path-breaking victory, the first woman president, Kamala Harris.
My predictions have stood the test of time.
The keys are the North Star, the unchanging system.
And you are sticking right now that the keys predict that Vice President Harris wins the election in 6 days.
That's right.
It's possible, but a lot would have to go wrong for Harris to lose.
What do we say? We don't know. We don't know. We've never known. For as much as we thought we knew, we don't know. Predicting the future is not possible. We are completely blind and ignorant. If you go back and search Alan Lichtman, kind of his post-election kind of autopsy, you will hear him talk about how he needs to change the keys. Fascinating. They don't work anymore. Why? Because just like we look to the past through a funhouse mirror, we are completely blind as to what is coming in the future. We really, really don't know. Artificial intelligence is kind of the big thing to talk about. We're in Silicon Valley, right? What's going to happen in the future? Well, according to a lot of the headlines that I've seen, we're not going to exist anymore. 5-10 years, destruction of humanity. This is something that I'm like, okay, well, woohoo! What do you do about that? Do they know? And I know this is very audacious of me, given that I'm not in that field of work, but this is very, they don't know. They don't know. Nobody knows. We don't know. The other example of why the future is very difficult and challenging is because we can't actually see beyond our own existence right here and right now. One of the things that's kind of terrifying about climate change and the idea that what we are doing to our planet is pretty terrifying, but that it's for 70, 80 years since we've known about this, we've done nothing. And carbon emissions have continued. We are at the highest peak of carbon emissions. We're on track for 3 degrees. Why? Because part of the reason is we can't see. The blindness to the future is also now hindering what it is that we do in here. Alvin Toffler, in his book, Future Shock, talks about some of the reasons why we can't see into the future. Here's a couple of them: rapid pace of change, information explosion, social political disruption, technological advances, outpacing human adaptation, that's a big one, short-term thinking, and psychological overload. We just simply do not have the capacity to make this, to think about it very, very clearly. We are blind to the future, and we just simply can't see it. In the words of the great Yogi Berra, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. We just simply can't do it. So, what I'm proposing to you, my friends, is this. We have, throughout history, marked time. That time, year one, is to give us a sense of who we are, how we live in this world, our identity, sense of ethics. But what happened in the past is just a fun, we're just trying to recreate a narrative, a story to tell us about what it is that we're going into the future and believing that the future is set in stone, and it just simply isn't. And with that, if that happens to be the case, I'm going to propose to you that is one of the reasons why the spiritual practice, the religious discipline of recognizing that this moment right here, right now that we have, actually really is the most important moment of your life. What happened then is history. It's never happened before. What's happening now has never happened before. It's never going to come again. And guess what? What we do here actually does matter into the future. And how we live in this particular moment, how we embrace this moment, is critical and key to our spiritual, psychological, emotional, and even physical health. Remember this book, Gabor Mate, When the Body Says No? It's brilliant. The research literature has identified three factors that universally lead to stress: uncertainty, the lack of information, and the loss of control. All three are present in the lives of individuals with chronic illness. Read that list. Uncertainty. The lack of information. And the loss of control. Does that sound familiar to you, given what we've talked about? That's exactly what lives in those two places, in the past and in the future. What we don't know, what we can't control, and what we just simply will not ever know about. So once again, this moment is the most important. And how you embrace it, how you think about it, how you utilize the history and the future is all part of what informs this. There are way too many biblical and spiritual and Jesus-centered themes for me to discuss at this particular moment. I'm just going to touch on two. Remember and believe. The word remember, the command to remember, is one of the most often cited commandments in the entire biblical corpus. Remember, do not forget. Remember, do not forget. Our English word, remember, is not about think about the past. It is to remember, to put it back into your body. It is an incarnational term. To remember is to take an idea, a concept, a thought, a spiritual discipline, and put it back into your body right here, right now. To remember is not simply to recall. It is to live in this moment according to how your remembrance, how the story, the narrative of who you are and how you understand yourself to be. To remember, again, member, the members of your body. And then, of course, believe is the term to trust and to live out, to walk. Believe isn't just the intellectual assent. Oh, I can sign off on the statement of faith, I believe. No, to believe is to take that actual next step, to trust, to place your life into the hands, to the feet, into the motion and the movement of the thing that you say that you believe. Also, Alvin mentions this. The illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. That's the remembering piece. It's a brilliant idea. There's so many different passages. Deuteronomy 8, be careful that you do not forget the Lord. There's that remembering. Now, listen to this. Failing to observe his commands, his laws, his decrees that I'm giving to you this day. The not forgetting and the remembering is about this moment, right here, right now. It's not just living in the past. It's about what you do in this moment, which is both a combination of the past and the future. To believe, multiple passages on this. We got Colossians chapter 3. We've got Proverbs chapter 3, John chapter 3, Romans chapter 5. It just goes on and on and on. Set your minds on the things that are above, right here, right now. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. to live in this moment is a profound spiritual discipline. Not to know, not to have certainty and a sense of almost arrogance about what will come right here, right now. Matthew 6 is Jesus' core teaching on this. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? I mean, that last line has always perplexed me. Set in this particular context, life being live out this moment, then worrying about the things that you need to come. And then, of course, he ends this passage in Matthew 6, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all of these things will be given. Live in this particular moment right here, right now, in a very pithy, hallmarky way. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That is why we call it the present. So, my friends, I'm going to suggest to you that this moment that we have right here is year one. Tomorrow will also be year one. And the day after that will also be year one. Why? Because every single day, every single moment is another opportunity to no longer be manipulated by the past and to no longer be blinded by what we think certainty is to come, but to embrace this moment, to remember into our own bodies what this life is and could and should be, and to live it out in that moment. We have no idea what the future is going to hold. So part of the reason why we're devastated by tragedy, shocked by the news, horrified at the developments in our communities, in our country, in our church. Why did we ever think that we knew what was going to come? What lulled us into thinking that we knew? And especially when we read our text and our stories, we have no clue. These people had no clue. So that, my friends, is my suggestion to you, to consider that this moment right here and right now really is the most important moment of your life. We're going to go to communion. I'm going to ask the team to come up again. This song, Junior chose this song for us to sing actually today. And it's so apropos for this, because very much like the not knowing and the uncertainty, the sense of, okay, I'll just do whatever this next thing is supposed to be, is part of what this next song is all about that we've done before in the past. So I hope you enjoy it. As we sing this song, we're going to encourage you to take communion. And the communion portion is once again that symbol of the past and the future coming together. In fact, Paul says, when you take the elements, that you are declaring Christ's death until he comes. Both the past and the future found together in that particular moment. So we're going to sing, and as we do, we're going to consider these questions that Joseph asked about the saving of the world. And then we will invite you to partake of the elements as we do. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." My friends, all are welcome at this table, no matter who you are, whatever your past, whatever your history, you are welcome. So as we sing, please come.